From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made over the phone when a young woman was receiving what may have been the most exciting news of her life. 20-year-old actress Marlee Matlin had just learned that she had been nominated for an Academy Award for her performance in Children of a Lesser God. The press was looking for her reaction, and Matlin's response seemed rather simple. She said, "Well, I'll scream about it later. I'll scream later." That sentence later came to be the title of her autobiography, I'll Scream Later. In that book, she shared the story of learning about the nomination while she was at the Betty Ford Clinic. Matlin had been struggling with an addiction to drugs and had decided to ask for help. That was in 1987. Today, she's celebrating more than 30 years of sobriety. Matlin has been outspoken about her battle with substance abuse and about the stereotypes she's faced as a deaf actress in Hollywood. She says her goal is to use her platform to help others who may be struggling, and she'll be doing that in Rochester on Thursday as the keynote speaker for East House's Hope and Recovery Luncheon. The annual event is meant to raise awareness and understanding of mental and substance abuse disorders and to celebrate people in recovery. This hour, we've got a chance to hear from Marlee Matlin, and we'll talk to some local folks in recovery about their journeys. I'll welcome our guests now, and the people we're talking about are Walter and Sarah, who are individuals living in recovery from addiction. So welcome to both of you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And our thanks and hello to Greg Soner, President and CEO of East House. Greg, welcome back. How are you?
Thank you, Evan. Thanks for having us.
Every year, you bring in very interesting people, and this year, you've got Marlee Matlin. How did you make that connection?
Well, we look for somebody who has a very inspiring story and who can communicate that and energize our audience and our community. And she has a wonderful story. I mean, I think certainly she has 30 years of sobriety. She has an amazing life story. And she also has this dual stigma where she has a disability, deaf and hearing impaired, and she was written off after she won her Academy Award because she's just a novelty. She's just this deaf actress. So she was dealing with her stigma around her own recovery, but also the fact that people just didn't think she was that capable and she would kind of go away. And 30 years later, turn on your TV and check out YouTube, and there she is.
Dancing with the Stars. She happens to be, the episode of Seinfeld she was in is a top five episode, the lip reading episode. Yeah, the lip reader is one of the top five episodes, and I actually went to YouTube to watch that this morning. And now she does a lot of conversation, presentation about these subjects. Is this a case where, because of what you do at East House, you know, you get a number of people in the recovery community who happen to be in the celebrity community? She was on the list for a while, or how did this kind of come to be for you?
Well, we're always looking 12 months a year for interesting personalities. And again, somebody with either a personal story or somebody who's has a family story in recovery, but mental health and substance abuse. And every year we just find somebody that just captures our attention, and we feel that purpose of the launch is certainly to educate and motivate the community. So they got to be not just to have a great story, but they have to be able to communicate it too. And you know, she's an actress. She has a magnetic personality. So I think she's going to be a home run for us.
Yeah, absolutely. So the 10th annual Hope and Recovery Luncheon coming up. Reservations are still available to be made. Yes.
Yes, please. Tickets are available. Check out easthouse.org or call 238-4800. We'd love to see you there.
It's at the Riverside Convention Center. So let's listen to this conversation. WXXI's Megan Mack, our producer, had a chance to talk with Marlee Matlin about her journey. She joined us on the phone from Los Angeles, and you're going to hear Marlee Matlin speaking through her sign language interpreter, her longtime interpreter. That's Jack Jason.
Marlee Matlin, thank you for joining us on Connections.
Thank you very much. And if you're wondering, I'm speaking through my sign language interpreter, Jack Jason.
Well,
just so
nice.
You know, I don't have a man's voice.
Well, it's so nice to have you both here. And Marlee, we really appreciate your time, and I know they do at East House as well. You've been very willing to talk about the challenges you faced as someone who struggled with addiction, and you've been generous in discussing your journey to sobriety as well. Why was it important for you to speak out and share that?
I think, like a lot of things that are in the news today, there's a hesitation on the part of people that if they have a journey that they're going through that's difficult, or if there's some barrier that they have to overcome, that they have to do it alone. And I And I wanted to tell people, just like a lot of people are doing these days, that you're not alone and that there are people out there just like yourself who are going through the same journey, who have gone through the same experiences, and that it's important for someone like myself to share the experiences that I've had so that it can allow you, if you're in a place where you're stuck or you feel like you can't overcome this barrier, that you can overcome the barrier, that you can break through and come out on the other side a better person. It's a matter of just sharing with each other the stories that we have. I think a lot of people are willing to keep it to themselves and don't realize that there are many, many stories just like theirs out there. And so it takes people like myself, or you don't have to be famous. You can just be a regular person. But tell your story so that others can find the light. I guess that's a cliche, but to find a light at the end of the tunnel.
When it comes to discussing addiction, I think there are elements of stereotyping, and sometimes a person may look at someone who has struggled and perhaps judge them or not consider the context of that situation, how they came to be in that place. Is that something that you've experienced, Marley, in conversations that you've had?
Well, I think that when people think of me, they think first deaf. So they think, okay, I live in a world of silence, and I always make a point of saying that silence is not who I am and that I'm actually a very loud person. And two, then they think about all the other issues that might be related to deafness, like hearing aids and does she speak and so forth. But those are just a small or one part of me. I mean, there's all sorts of other parts of me. I'm a mom, I'm an actor, I'm an activist, I'm an author, I'm a producer, and I'm also a survivor, and I'm also a recovering addict, and I've been sober for 33 years, and it's just another part of who I am. And I think that people, because they don't know this part of me, are probably more interested in finding, oh, wait, how did you make it through? Or what is it that, you can give us as advice for someone we know who's struggling in the same way that you might have once struggled? So it's going out and speaking is just my way of helping raise awareness and break down stereotypes of what most people think deaf people are like, which we are all different. We all, live our lives differently. I did a special just this past week for A&E Network about three different families that are deaf. And the point I wanted to make was that there are, yes, 35 million deaf and hard of hearing people in the United States, but we all are different. And we all shouldn't be lumped into one box, and that we all have different lives and different needs. And that's what I aim to do.
That's such a good point. And I think that relates to stories of addiction as well. So everyone has a different journey. Everyone has a different story. Everyone has a different way in which they got to the place where they are. And Marley, your story involves trauma. You were sexually abused as a child, later as a teenager. How did that contribute to your struggles with addiction?
Well, I think I'm not a therapist, and in rehab, we might have talked about this, but I think that might have contributed to my desire to not speak about those experiences, might have contributed to my desire to sort of fall into the drug habit that I had. I think it was probably because, and also addiction ran in my family. My grandfather was an alcoholic, and I know that my dad worked very hard not to fall into the same trap. But a lot of people want to find out the seed that begins one's addiction, and I think that it might have been the abuse that I suffered, but I tend to look at what I did to overcome it as opposed to where it started, because it was so long ago, and also because one can never know exactly what it is that you did that caused you to be the addict, or what it is that you got involved in, or so forth. But I think it's important to look at the person now, today. Let's get them to a point where they can heal themselves. But yeah, I think that probably was one of the mitigating factors for my addiction, certainly.
You make a good point, though. We shouldn't simplify an experience based on one specific situation or multiple situations.
It's a lot of factors that fall into it. It could be, the friends that I had. It could be the lack of communication that I might have had with certain individuals in my life, people who couldn't sign. It could have been the fact that it was, there's a family history of addiction. It could be that I just liked the experience of doing drugs. It could have been a lot of things. But I think what's important now is that I'm sober today, and I'm working on my sobriety every day, and happy to say that I'm very proud of my journey. But yes, it's important, but let's not make it the entire story.
Absolutely. And congratulations on 33 years of sobriety. I know that provides a lot of inspiration to people listening, especially...
It was January 1987. So is that... That's 31. Sorry.
Congratulations still. That's a remarkable feat. Congratulations on that. And I know that you've said in interviews that your family has been key in this. And I do want to quote from your book for a moment, because since you brought up that date, January 9th, 1987, you said, quote, "But consider January 9th, 1987. I was due to fly the next day to be with Bill, William Hurt, at Betty Ford as part of his therapy. I knew they would just bust me about my drug use, so I tried to finish everything I had, a gram of coke, a half-ounce bag of pot. I knew I needed help," end quote. Marley, when you got to that point, you were going to Betty Ford with your then-boyfriend, William Hurt. What led you to say, "I need help, I'm ready to seek help"?
Well, it's funny because he was there. I was visiting him during that family week. And I think it was just the fact that I would be in such a public place that, I mean, I could hide in the past in my sign language world, in my with my deaf friends and the people that I did drugs with. But I think when I realized that I would be in such a public setting and I would actually sit down and talk about what my life had been about, I thought that I couldn't do it and go in and not be honest. And to be honest, you have to be clean. And so I thought, you know what, that was it. It didn't have like this rock, you know, I wasn't on the street strung out or you know, forging through garbage cans or anything like some people think what bottom is. Bottom is just the realization that I think I have to stop. And at that point, I just realized I'm going to be in a public setting. I'm going to have to talk about this. I need to talk about this openly and honestly, and therefore I must be clean. So I stopped, and it was as simple as that.
And all of this was happening when you were seeing a remarkable amount of success in your career. So you found out you won an Academy Award for your role in Children of a Lesser God, and you were just 19. You're seeing all of the success, and in a moment like that, you probably want to enjoy it, but you're trying to cope with many of these things, and you're at the clinic. And I know this story led to the title of your book, I'll Scream Later. Can you tell our listeners about that?
So my sobriety started January the 9th, 1987. At the end of January, I went to the Golden Globe ceremony and won the Golden Globe for Best Actress. I won the Golden Globe for Best Actress. Sorry about that phone in the background. For Best Actress. I then decided the next day to check myself into the Betty Ford Clinic to work on my recovery and actually focus on getting sober, even though I stopped doing drugs. And while I was at the Betty Ford Clinic, I got the information that I got nominated for an Academy Award, which I think probably sounds like it's out of a movie, but it happened, and no one knew where I was. No one except my interpreter knew that I was at Betty Ford, but had to relay the information to me. And when he told me that I had been nominated, he asked for a response because the press was going to print my reaction. And so he said, "What do you want to say?" And I said, I can't talk now. I need to do it later. So I just said, "Well, I'll scream later." And I used the scream because most people think, you know, deaf people are silent. And so I thought it was being funny, too, at the same time. But it also was a metaphor for my life, because whatever was happening to me, whether it was either sexually abused or I was, you know, doing drugs, or I was involved in a relationship that was violent, I sort of pushed everything till later. And so it was, I'll Scream Later is both trying to be funny and me being confessional and saying that's how I approach life at the beginning. And I'll do it later. I'll worry about that later. Isn't that what Scarlett O'Hara said in Gone with the Wind? She said, "Oh, I'll think about that tomorrow." So same idea. So it works on many levels. It's a deaf thing. It's a confessional thing. And I think it worked. The book was a New York Times bestseller. So,
and listeners, it's called I'll Scream Later. Again, if you missed that, and we can put a link to that on our podcast page for this episode. Marley, I want to ask you a couple questions about the impact that addiction can have on families, because sometimes when a person who is struggling isn't ready to make a change, or perhaps they don't see that they have a problem, family members or friends might say, how can I help my loved one without isolating them, without closing the door to a conversation, without making them defensive or pressuring them? How would you approach that? How would you talk to someone who perhaps has a family member where they see that there might be something that they're struggling with, but they're not sure how to approach it?
You know, I'm always a big believer in communication. And I think the first thing to do, because my life has sort of been an example of how important communication is, because I communicate in a different language. I think it's always important to open the lines of communication and make people feel as if they are open and welcome to communicate whatever issue they might have or concern that they have. So, and if it comes to a point where the communication just you can't accomplish it for some reason, then turn to an expert, a counselor or a clergy person or someone who can help open up the lines and make it so that everyone is comfortable and free to communicate. Because I think a lot of problems that happen, especially when we're talking about addiction, result because there's just not enough communication, or people are keeping secrets, or people are holding things inside. And I think once things get out on the table, then you can begin to talk about how to deal with it and a potential road to recovery. But you can't do it unless you're talking, unless you're communicating.
I know you've probably heard a lot of stories throughout the years as you've shared your stories. And I'd like to ask you, is there one person whose story has really inspired you? You've been an inspiration for so many people. You've shared your struggles, your journey, and have helped many people communicate, as you just said. But is there someone that you've spoken with over the years that you thought, wow, this person has inspired me?
Well, I always turn to in my presentations, the person that really motivated and inspired me, and that's Henry Winkler, or should I say now, Emmy Award-winning Henry Winkler. He just won the Emmy on Monday, and he deserved it after 40 years, my goodness. When I was 12 years old, I expressed a desire to be an actor. He came to visit a theater where I was working as a young actress, and I said, I want to be an actor in Hollywood just like you, and he had to deal with people who had doubts about my ability to be an actor, not my skill or my ability, but about rather the opportunities out there that would be denied me simply because people saw me as someone who's deaf, and therefore, how could she be an actor? She's deaf. So he encouraged those people to look beyond that and encouraged me particularly to just plow forward and believe in myself and follow my heart and follow my dreams, because he had the same issues himself. He grew up with a situation where he was labeled as slow, as dumb. His parents doubted his ability to even achieve because he had difficulty reading in school. And it wasn't until many, many years later when his son had the same problems that he found out there was a name for the issue he was having, and that was dyslexia, and that he carried this dyslexia all throughout his life. But rather than let the dyslexia define him, he just went ahead and did what he wanted to do, and he studied acting and went to schools when a lot of other schools turned him down, and eventually he went to New York, and then he came to L.A. and became probably one of the most well-known actors in the entertainment business simply because he decided not to listen to people, and he chose to follow his heart. So he gave me that inspiration, and I was 12 years old at the time, and then 8 years later, 8.5 years later, I'm standing on a stage with an Oscar in my hand. And I know that it's not only because of him, but he certainly was a big part of that. So Henry was a big part of my motivation and my desire to achieve. He also helped me out when I needed help, when I left New York and I didn't have any place to go because my relationship with my boyfriend ended very badly. And he asked me to stay for the weekend to think it over, and that weekend turned into 2 years. And he and his wife couldn't have been more lovely people, and I got married at their house, and I just went there last night for the end of the Jewish holidays. He's really a person who has inspired and motivated me a million times over, and I can never thank him enough. He's like a second father.
Well, we're down to our last few minutes with you, Marley, and I want to talk about some of those barriers that exist in Hollywood. So we're seeing a lot of conversations about changes and the inclusion of more people of color, people with disabilities, deaf actors. Would you say we're moving in the right direction? How do you feel about the extent of the progress? Does it frustrate you? Are you feeling optimistic about it? Where do you stand?
It's coming along. I mean, there's certainly a lot more out there, opportunities for actors who are deaf. I mean, there's television shows created by deaf people that's currently on the Sundance Channel. Certainly, we just had a year of a TV show called Quantico, which I starred in, and I'm working on another show called The Magicians. There are many, many other actors out there, and you're seeing them, deaf, people with other disabilities, working. But there's still, you know, issues. I mean, the other day I had to talk about on Twitter about a gentleman who decided to cast a hearing actress in a deaf role and talked about how you'd think she was deaf. She studied so hard. And then went on to describe a film that was probably exactly like a movie last year called A Quiet Place, or this year. It's, you know, people assuming because it's art or I'm an artist that I can recreate the experience of a person who is deaf is you're right. You can do it. It's fine. But it's just not the right thing to do because it's not authentic. You wouldn't want a person who is Caucasian playing an African-American person. And I know that's an extreme example. But you just don't get the same experience on the screen with somebody who is not deaf playing deaf as you would if you used a deaf actor. And I know people will say, well, isn't that what acting is about, playing somebody different from yourself? Well, yes. I would say that unless you wrote that part specifically tailored to that person is going to be acting. I was accused of not acting in Children of a Lesser God. And why did I get the Oscar? Because I wasn't acting. I was just being me. Well, no, I wasn't. That character wasn't who I was. I was acting. So I think we still have a long ways to go when it comes to casting authentically, and also creating roles that feature deaf characters that aren't about being deaf, that aren't dwelling on the victimhood that a lot of people who aren't deaf think deaf people should play. So there's still a long way to go, but it's much, much better. And thanks to social media, we're making noise whenever we see something wrong.
We had a conversation recently on this program about that very issue, but when it comes to actors who are LGBTQ and characters that are LGBTQ. And one of the points that we took away from the conversation is the stories that are told, the people at the table who are working on those stories need to be the people who fit the demographics of the character. So if we're telling the stories of deaf characters, deaf people need to be at the table, producers, writers, directors.
Right.
How are we doing on that front, Marley?
As much as that, I mean, it comes from both ends. Deaf people have to be willing to step up to the plate and write and direct and produce. And they are. They're doing that. But they can't do it if they aren't met on the other side with people who are willing to give them the opportunity. I know that networks are like ABC has a program where they're encouraging people with disabilities or who are deaf or hard of hearing to participate more in the casting process, in the auditioning process, and in the acting process. So there is an effort. It's just, it's slow again. And I don't want to say it's understandable, but a lot of people don't have the ability to see outside themselves. And so if they don't, they only write from their own experiences. And if they could only take a moment to think outside the box, they'd get a much more interesting, much more creative look at life. Look at, this is an extreme example again, creative way of looking at things, Crazy Rich Asians. Nobody would have thought that a movie with a cast of all Asian people would do so well because they just didn't do it. But once they did it, it did well. So you just have to take the chance to tell stories that are outside of your experience, that are outside of the box that you live and work and write or produce or direct it. And you'll find a much greater, much richer world. And at the same time, deaf people need to be able to put themselves out there, feel encouraged to create their own stories. If nobody's going to write them for them, then write it ourselves. And that's what we're doing. People are doing that. This Close is a show that I'm participating in. It was written by a woman who's deaf who was tired of waiting for parts to come. So she wrote her own part, and now she has a successful TV show on.
Well, Marley, I know you have to run. I want to thank you sincerely for your time and for sharing your story with us and to all our listeners. We really appreciate you joining us. You'll be the keynote speaker at the East House Hope and Recovery Luncheon, so we will see you in Rochester very soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
That's Marley Matlin speaking to WXXI's Megan Mack through her longtime interpreter, Jack Jason. And the event coming up for the East House 10th Annual Hope and Recovery Luncheon at the Riverside Convention Center. Jump on easthouse.org or call 238-4800. If you want to make reservations, you can still do that. Our only break of the hour is coming up, and then a conversation with individuals about their recovery process. We'll also talk about the mission of East House, all coming up next on Connections. Let me tell you what is coming up tomorrow on the next Connections. What would the U.S. Constitution look like today if it were created from scratch? An upcoming panel discussion hosted by the Rochester Public Library explores that question. We'll preview the event with a conversation about how to address modern issues in a new constitution, what laws would look like, state versus federal rights, and more. That's tomorrow on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So you just heard Marley Matlin talking to our Megan Mack, and now we welcome back Greg Soner, President and CEO of East House, and a couple of individuals living in recovery. Walter and Sarah are with us sharing their stories, and I want to start by asking our guests what stood out from that conversation with the remarkable Marley Matlin. Greg?
Well, a couple things. I think the idea that being deaf or being in recovery are parts of herself. They don't define her totally, and we're all like that. We all have complex pieces, and I think we all resent being identified as one dimension of that. So I thought that was very powerful, and the fact that she, you know, she had a pivot point in her life where she decided that she needed to get recovery, and I think of, you know, I had a pivot point like that, which I won't bore you with the details, but you just realize you have to change. You have to change your life, and so I think those two things that we're complex. There are many parts to ourselves, and that we come across these pivot points in our lives, and then that we have somebody who inspires us. And so,
yeah, and but Greg, I mean, I on the subject of a pivot point, we hear quite often from people, and in a moment we'll hear a couple of other stories, but we hear often that it's difficult, if not impossible, to move into recovery from addiction if you're not ready, if you're not willing to try to do some of the work to grab it. And I just want to kind of take your temperature on how we help people move in that direction. I mean, there's got to be some individual self-starting going on, but there also has to be support. That's not easy to accomplish that.
Yeah, we were just talking about that in the lobby, and I feel like we're generally a pretty impatient society,
yeah.
And we want things to happen and happen quickly, and I think recovery is a process. It's a self-defined process. I do believe, and I've seen, that there are moments where people have that pivot point or they have that motivation, so rapid access to support is important. But it doesn't mean you change overnight. It doesn't mean you're better in a day. It means you're starting your journey. And I think Sarah and Walter can speak to that better than I. But we have to be more patient. We have to be more patient with recovery.
How many people does East House serve?
Today we have 700 people in various forms of housing and in recovery. And we serve over 1,500 people a year. So we're, I think, probably the biggest single provider of support and housing to people in recovery from mental health and substance abuse.
How much has the opioid crisis impacted the work in the recovery community?
Oh, it's several ways. I think as a provider, it's put a tremendous amount of stress on the provider community because, you know, one slip and you could be dead. And I know Sarah and Walter are in the field and know this. So I think it's put a lot of pressure on staff and our organization to do whatever we can to provide required supports. I think it's created a groundswell of community advocacy to get more support for people in recovery and for providers and for families. So I will say, from East House perspective, that money hasn't come to us yet, mm-hmm. but I would just encourage anyone in a position, you know, public service or public representatives that we need help. We need additional supports to wrap services around folks who really are in a life-threatening situation with their opioid addiction. So it's had a tremendous impact.
When it comes to recovery from addiction, every story is unique on its own, but there's also a lot that I think we can learn in solidarity as we hear some of these stories. And Sarah, I'll turn to you, and I'll kind of step off, give you the floor, and why don't you tell us about your story?
Okay, well, my story started in 2008. I was using crack cocaine and prostituting for drugs in the streets of Rochester, and I had been living homelessly for the 10 years prior. And I, you know, I kept getting arrested, going in out of jail, didn't know anything about rehab or detox or anything like that. I just didn't have no working knowledge of those services. And I wasn't ready to be done, you know. So, I mean, I hear a lot about how people need to hit a bottom and they need to be willing, and that wasn't my story. I was tired of being tired, and I was tired of living on the streets, but that was a comfortable bottom for me. And that's kind of what happened. I got comfortable in the lows, and I adapted to the lifestyle of the street, and my behaviors continued to feed my addiction and vice versa. And I went to jail on July 8th, 2008 was my last use. And I don't know what happened. I was in the back of the cop car, and I was facing some prison time. I had 4 warrants, and I gave him my real name, and I went to jail. And I don't know what happened in that. That wasn't the first time I was arrested. That wasn't the first time I ever had, you know, been tired. I can't tell you what happened that night, other than I got in the back of the cop car, and just this sense of relief came over me. And I don't know if it was a moment of clarity or a moment of surrendering or what it was, but I was tired of getting in trouble. I was tired of the consequences. I wasn't convinced that this was going to be my last use. There was, you know, I wasn't just giving up, but I wanted to handle my legal situation, get it past me so that I could continue doing what I was doing without the consequences. And I sat in jail and went in front of the judge and asked the judge to send me upstate, because I didn't think that this idea of getting clean and never using and recovery, I didn't really have a working knowledge. I didn't know what I didn't know. So,
but what did you want the judge to do?
I wanted him to send me to prison. I wanted her to send me to prison. I asked Judge Marks from the Rochester Drug Treatment Court to sentence me all my time. And I was facing 2 to 4 upstate for all of the charges that I have accumulated and took off and on the run. And I really, by this point in time, I had dwindled down to animalistic behaviors, and I was a threat to my community. I was a threat to anybody that came in my path, and I was a threat to myself.
And you knew it?
I knew it.
You felt that? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I knew it. And I didn't think that, I didn't know anything about recovery. I just thought it was either this way of living, because I couldn't stop, or be locked up in an institution or in a jail. And I didn't think that, I don't know, I didn't see myself in recovery. I didn't know that was even a possibility. I knew nothing about it.
How did it happen?
I went in front of the judge, and she told me that she would give me some time to think about that, and sent me back to my cell. And I sat there for another, 2 months, month and a half, and got more information as I was in jail, started going to the AA meetings they were bringing in, starting to talk to other women in jail. And, you know, when I went back in front of her, she offered me a plea to go bed to bed. And I didn't even know what that was.
Well, explain.
So I guess, well, not I guess, but bed to bed is when you go from one bed in a facility to another bed in another facility when that bed is available. And I didn't know of any of these places. They were asking to send me, they're offering to send me. But I did know one thing. I did know that if it didn't work out, there was always, I could always go back to doing what I was doing or go back and get sentenced. So it was really this last go round with Sarah. And so I prepared myself to go to that first bed placement, and the offer on the table was a house called Jennifer House here in the community. It's part of Spiritus Christi Prison Outreach. And that was my first stop. I was released from jail on the front porch of Jennifer House. And that's kind of where my journey started in 2008, August 4th to be exact, 2008. Was kind of the first choice I had made a choice in over a decade that wasn't dictated by my drug use, which was pretty powerful.
Yeah, I assume you were addicted.
Very addicted.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you're living in recovery, but I mean, when I say that, I mean, I assume you made that choice knowing that you still felt that need or want for it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an amazing choice to make.
Hardest choice I've ever made in my life by far, but the best choice I've ever made in my life. And I continue to make that choice, but it's not an easy fight. It's a daily battle. Sometimes it's an hourly struggle. But that, you know, that choice to stay and actually follow through with treatment recommendations and the plans that were on the table for me has been the best gift ever in my life, you know. And I went from Jennifer House I stayed at Jennifer House for about 50, 60 days, and then I went on to East House, Penny Cook. And that's a halfway house for women. And I just got on fire for recovery. I was loving it. I was loving waking up, not thinking about drugs, and going to bed not thinking about drugs, and taking a shower and having clean clothes and eating a hot meal. And it was just like this whole new world, you know, that I hadn't had in a while. And so I was able to complete the East House program at Penny Cook, and then East House helped me get into supportive living and their program there. And then I was coming upon graduation from drug court, successful graduation, and decided that I should probably try to make a career with my life. And I started going to MCC and got an associate's degree in addictions counseling. And I left successfully out of the treatment apartment program into my own apartment, and haven't looked really back. Haven't looked back, you know.
It's an awesome story.
Yeah.
It's really a remarkable story.
And Jennifer, now, or Sarah, now you're working at Jennifer.
Well, yeah. So that's kind of like, that's another chapter in this book is, you know, I had a couple jobs just to kind of, you know, find my way. And I work for the state, the New York State, which is amazing in and of itself because I was once property of the state and now I work for the state. So that's pretty cool. But, you know, I got a phone call and I was asked to be the director of Jennifer House. And that is my current full-time job now, is I'm the director of Jennifer House. And that's just an honor in and of itself to be there for the next woman. And open up the door to that person who's struggling and doesn't have a voice and feels like if they did have a voice, it wouldn't be heard because of the stigma wrapped around the disease of addiction. And yeah, so it's just an honor. It's just an honor to be that person. I love it. And, you know, since then, I've just gained so much. You know, I'm married. I have a beautiful husband who went through East House, and we have children. And I just bought my very first house. We just bought our first house. And wow. I'm employed and productive member of my society, and I'm giving back, and, you know, just, it just goes on and on and on and on and on. And I can't thank East House enough for that, Spiritus Christi enough for believing in me as well, and the people that do support me.
You know? If I were to have found you in 2005 and told you in 2018, this is what you're going to be doing.
I don't know if you would have found me in 2005 because yeah. I hid so well. But I can tell you that I would have been a couple streets over on Lyle Avenue. And I would have been probably 92 pounds.
What was a day like?
A day in the life of an addict?
Yeah. What was an average day like for you, if there was
one? So they kind of blended together because I didn't sleep much, because crack cocaine doesn't allow you to get the type of sleep you need. But let's say I would wake or come to in one of these abandoned houses. I wouldn't have any money or any drugs. And I would, you know, canvas Jones Park, Saratoga Street, all of the streets around Ambrose, all the streets around Lyle Avenue. And I would hop in a car of a John. And usually it would start out very viciously because I haven't had any drugs in me and I'm starting to go through some withdrawal. So that was really like victim number one, always dealt with the worst of me. And I would get my money and, or I would try to get a dealer to front me a bag until I could catch a, you know, what we consider a lick on the street. And then I'd be, you know, I'd get money and I'd try to avoid that dealer so that I could get all of that money and not have to repay back or, you know, just a series of chaos from the time I opened my eyes to try to feed this addiction. And it's just never enough. It was just never enough. You know, I could have $1,000 in my pocket and 10 bags in my pocket, whatever. It's just never enough. Your mind's always worried about what's going to happen when this goes. Where am I going to be? What's going to happen? And so you're already, you know, plotting your next move. And it's like if you turn that light switch on, you just become this monster and you just lose all your values and your morals and beliefs and things that people's, and you just sit there alone. Like I would just sit there alone and isolated and just inside be just dying inside, wishing I could be the person that I know I'm supposed to be.
And now I would think with your job, you have the real credibility to tell people, I understand.
Sure. Yeah. And I don't try to use that too much because our situations are different. I want them to really own their recovery. But they know. They know I understand. You know, they know my trials and tribulations, and they know that recovery is individualized and that it's possible and that we're going to try to get them to where they need to be. And on the straight and narrow, you know, depending on what they say they need. You know, and but it's that internal pain is just, it's horrible.
Sarah, what a story.
Thank you.
It's really amazing. I keep using that word. I don't know what else to say. But I know people are going to hear that and know that after 10 years, it's a long time, you still found a way. Let's turn to Walter, and we'll talk about Walter's story. Go ahead, Walter.
Yeah. Thanks. Glad to be here. And I'm just smiling ear to ear as I'm hearing your story, because I know you professionally, and I would never have known that you have gone through that, you know what I mean? And I could relate, because our stories are very similar. My story began early on at age 15, when I first picked up alcohol. Prior to that, I was, you know, I had some things going on. And none of this I attribute to my alcoholism or my addiction. But, you know, I came from foster care. I was adopted. Always felt that sense of not wanted, you know, having that void in my life, not knowing my real parents. I got adopted into a family who, God bless them, you know, they were doing their best. But, you know, they struggled at certain points with alcoholism and just rage and anger, and I just witnessed brutality that scarred me as a kid. You know, some very brutal goings on. And what happened to me is I became very introverted, very kind of standoffish, leave me alone kind of kid, would not make waves. Went to Catholic school. I was an altar boy, Boy Scout. But as I got into my puberty, the anxiety level for me became really off the chart. And I noticed at one time I was asked to go to a debutante ball and escort a young woman from the neighborhood. And I remember learning the waltz with her mom, because that was part of the process. And I was just nervous. I couldn't understand why so nervous. And during the waltz, I accidentally stepped on her toe. And no one knew it. It wasn't. But to me, I hid in the basement of the Diplomat until the event ended, just because I was so anxious and afraid. And that was sort of the condition where I found alcohol. And man, that was magic when I first got that buzz. And everything relaxed, my thoughts slowed down. I had an instant group of friends, you know, people in our neighborhood. And So, yeah.
How old were you when that happened?
15.
15.
By 17, I was a full-blown alcoholic. I didn't know it, but my personality had changed. I was running with a rougher crowd. My whole purpose in life, you know, I did want to go become a veterinarian. Now all I wanted to do was hang out at the local pool hall, become the best pool shooter and pinball player. And drinking was just my life and my lifestyle. By 21, I was a blackout drinker. I had started getting in trouble with the law, and I had started experimenting with some heavy-duty drugs, freebase and cocaine back then. By age 25, I became an IV drug user. A number of overdoses, a lot of seizures going on, drinking around the clock. So it wasn't until I was 29, 30 years old, that I was court-mandated into treatment. And I went to Park Ridge. I didn't know what treatment was. I never knew what recovery was, didn't really believe in it. But I went for the first time, and just through a combination of starting to build relationships with people in my group and everything, I didn't drink and I didn't drug for the first time in 15 years. But you know what happened for me was I was still that scared little kid when I put the alcohol and the drugs down. I was an adult now, so I knew how to mask it a little better. And it was just on the surface. I still didn't know how to form relationships with people. I had never done anything as an adult, sober and not under the influence. Drive, have a girlfriend, make love, anything. You know, so now I'm just sort of out there. And I became a workaholic. And long story short, in 2000, you know, I had a really good house. So I had gotten married, living in the suburbs, the trucks, the motorcycle, the car. Daughter in private school, and my life started to fall apart again. The marriage I started to realize was not going to work. My dad was dying in a VA hospital in Canandaigua, and I just didn't have tools to deal with all of that. And the drink solution came back to me strong. And within 3 months of picking up that drink, my disease was back full blown, and I was back to where I was, you know, 9 years earlier. Wow. And worse.
And so how did you end up at East House?
I ended up at my bottom was September, the week of September 24th, 2002. So I celebrated 16 years of recovery yesterday. And that week there, I had boarded myself. I had gotten released from jail for drug charges, barricaded myself in this house on Curtis Street, a crack house. And it just became psychotic, and with all the drugs that I had done, I lost my mind. And I basically overdosed, was taken to the hospital, and went into outpatient treatment, and one of the counselors there did a referral for me to East House, and also to a referral for the first time to a MICA program, where I was able to go and have an evaluation and get diagnosed with this anxiety disorder related to a lot of the trauma that I experienced.
All the way going back. So you get that figured out. You get the help and the support from East House.
Yes.
And as I look at the clock here, I'm just gripped by you, Sarah and Walter's stories. In our last couple of minutes, tell us how you're doing now.
I'm doing fantastic. I'm stay sober by connecting with the fellowship of people that live a spiritually based life. My life now is really directed by God to the best of my ability. I live recovery, I breathe recovery, and I'm so grateful for this opportunity to do this. I went back to school, became a social worker, graduated with a master's degree in social work. I'm a licensed clinical social worker now. I work at an outpatient mental health clinic, and I work with us day in and day out. You know, and it's beyond my wildest dreams. Relationships with my parents, with my mom and my daughter are great. I have an 8-year-old grandson who's never seen me high or drunk or acting out of character. I just have a wonderful life, and it's all recovery. So I appreciate the opportunity to come out and share.
Oh, Walter, we're so grateful that you and Sarah shared these stories and put them out there for the public to understand that that relapse happens, that challenge happens, that there are certain obstacles in recovery. It's not all smooth. But we look at both of you, and it's amazing stuff. So as we get ready to close the hour, Greg Soner from East House, tell us one more time how people can get involved, what's going on here this week.
We have our luncheon on Thursday. Go to easthouse.org or call 238-4800. We'll see you at the convention center I think Walter and Sarah will be there if you want to talk to them. And I just want to say, if you're listening and you want to do this kind of work, you can hear from some people tell me, oh, your work is so hard and depressing. But you listen to Sarah and Walter, and it's just so inspiring. I want to run back and go to work right now.
Yeah, it really is amazing and important, powerful stuff. Thanks to both of you for sharing these stories. Continued success to you. Again, we know recovery is not a smooth, straight line, but you're really walking the walk, and thank you for being here to tell us about it.
Thank you.
Greg, thank you. Have a good week here.
Thank you for having me.
Big day on Thursday. It's a very important day for them, and they describe so many of the needs in our community that East House, as part of our recovery community, tries to work on. So easthouse.org. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, Megan Mack, producer and host today. Wonderful interview with Marley Matlin. Thanks for listening, and we will talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.